to consider relocating the British embassy to Al-Quds. Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the eternal capital of Palestine.
We came here today to support Al-Aqsa and to say to the whole world that Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line. We also want to condemn the British Prime Minister's statements about relocating the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds.
Palestinians have also condemned the international community's silence on Israeli crimes in Al-Quds.
Analysts say the Israeli regime and its regional and international backers are responsible for the escalation of violence in Al-Quds and Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The pressure from the cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs, due in part to the war in Ukraine, is pushing more and more Britons into poverty, among them people with jobs. Across the nation, business after business has also closed up shop. More could follow. The government's answer, unleashing tens of billions of dollars to protect businesses from rising energy costs. But for many, such measures don't go far enough.
People are still suffering quite big energy and inflation, you know, and real wage cuts. But not if you're at the top end. You're actually going to be delighted with your extra 5% tax cut on your million-pound salary. I mean, it is ludicrous.
A global shortage of essentials from fuel to flour have seemingly made everything more expensive. Inflation in the UK stands at just under 10%, the highest in 40 years and highest across all G7 countries. In response, the Bank of England has raised interest rates, the cost of borrowing, to their highest in more than a decade to try and slow down people's spending and bring down prices.
The government is moving in a different direction, slashing taxes to get people to spend more. Good news for businesses on, for example, high street, but bad news for inflation.
Now, Mr. Speaker, this brings me to the cap on bankers' bonuses.
New Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng has announced cuts to taxes on richest individuals and the biggest companies, along with lifting the cap on bankers' bonuses. He and his prime minister's theory is that if the rich are allowed to get richer, instead of shouldering more of the nation's tax burden, everyone will benefit. And it has a name, trickle-down economics. Very few economists think it's a good idea.
I don't think this is going to be received well by the British public. What we want is an improved health service, dealing with social care, and this is not the time to be cutting tax on the wealthy like this. It is, as I say, astonishingly inept.
In the past 10 years of Conservative government, the UK has experienced stagnated productivity, investment and wages. Many are questioning whether this government can really turn the tide on years of economic decline. Saeed Puriza, London.
The eight-year anniversary of the September 21st Yemeni revolution was marked in the Yemeni capital with a massive parade. In previous years, people used to flock the streets to celebrate the day all across the country. This year, Yemen's armed forces were the ones to march the streets. A broad range of advanced equipment such as missiles, unmanned aerial vehicles, and air defense systems were also put on display. Many in Yemen believe that the country's military development today is only a result of the revolution. A spokesman for the Yemeni military said that this year's parade is a warning to the Saudi-led coalition to end the war and stop its aggression.
We are awaiting the orders of Sayed Abdul Malik to take our positions on the military fronts in order to liberate our lands from every foreign invader.
A UN-backed ceasefire was signed back in April to end hostilities and pave the way for peaceful dialogue. Despite this, the Saudi government continues to impose an economic blockade on its impoverished neighbor. The kingdom's actions are also jeopardizing efforts for peace.
The ceasefire agreement is set to expire on October 2nd, and if not extended, could lead to the resumption of war. The Ansarullah leader has already said that the Yemeni army and allied fighters are prepared for any scenario. Yusuf Maori, Sana'a.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi wrapped up his first appearance at the United Nations General Assembly with a question and answer session with Western media. a range of subjects were covered. Raisi said that Iran's recent admittance to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will be mutually beneficial for all members. In reference to the anti-Iran terror group, the MKO, he rhetorically asked the West, "Why do you keep chanting slogans about fighting against terrorism while housing, giving support, and giving safe haven to them?" He demanded that all Palestinians finally be allowed to vote in referendums and in a transparent manner to decide their fate. Regarding the JCPOA, Raisi emphasized, "The important issue that matters today is sanctions relief." He continued, "Iran's need for guarantees is due to the bitter experience of America's prior noncompliance with the accord. The only side that kept living up to their side of the bargain was the Islamic Republic of Iran." While on the election campaign last year, one of Raisi's key themes was the idea that the world is not just the West.
"Our foreign policy is based on engagement with everyone, Eastern as well as Western. The previous administration targeted the West a bit more, but now we have adopted a more balanced approach. Any country which wants to have engagement with us, we will certainly pave the way to work with them, and with a priority to our neighboring countries."
Raisi's first speech at the United Nations seemed to fall on deaf ears in much of the Western media, even though it was full of progressive political ideals, such as the duty to help neighboring countries in hardship, the total refusal to obtain nuclear weapons, and the rejection of capitalism over morality.
"Arrogance. Some countries see themselves as more than or superior to others, perhaps because of their financial or military capabilities, and this is a true cause of oppression."
Many believe that few countries are as unobjectively and negatively portrayed by the Western mainstream media as Iran. Raisi's press conference was a chance for Western reporters to consider the Iranian view. Many hope their coverage will be more balanced in the future. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
"There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same."
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
"I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided."
"The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?"
A few days ago, the U.S. government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the U.S. move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
"I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the U.S. certainly did the same."
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have showed that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
And they think they can do the same thing here, what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades and never had any issues with them whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along. And they've caused so much grief here. And most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, call the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil, holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, Presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né?
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
In the limelight.
U.S. lawyers representing the former President Donald J. Trump in the investigation into his handling of classified documents have tried out an array of defenses as they seek to hold off the Justice Department. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush. The piece is titled, Trump's Legal Team Scrambles to Find an Argument. On 25th of May, one of former President Donald J. Trump's lawyers sent a letter to a top Justice Department official laying out the argument that his client had done nothing illegal by holding on to a trove of government materials when he left the White House. The letter from M. Evan Corcoran, a former federal prosecutor, represented Mr. Trump's initial defense against the investigation into the presence of highly classified documents in unsecured locations at his members-only club and residence at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. It amounted to a three-page hodgepodge of contested legal theories, including Mr. Corcoran's assertion that Donald Trump possessed a nearly boundless right as president to declassify materials, and an argument that one law governing the handling of classified documents does not apply to a president. M. Evan Corcoran asked the Justice Department to present the letter as exculpatory information to the grand jury investigating the case. Government lawyers found it deeply puzzling. They included it in the affidavit submitted to a federal magistrate in Florida in their request for the search warrant they later used to recover even more classified materials at Mar-a-Lago. To demonstrate their willingness to acknowledge Mr. Corcoran's arguments, a person with knowledge of the decision has said. As the partial release of the search warrant affidavit on Friday included the 25th of May letter, illustrated Donald Trump is going into the battle over the documents with a hastily assembled legal team. The lawyers have offered up a variety of arguments on his behalf that have yet to do much to fend off a Justice Department that has adopted a determined, focused, and so far largely successful legal approach. He needs a quarterback who's a real lawyer, said David Schoen, a lawyer who defended Donald Trump in his second Senate impeachment trial. David Schoen called it an honor to represent Mr. Trump, but said it was problematic to keep lawyers rotating in and out. Often tinged with Donald Trump's own bombast and sometimes conflating his powers as president with his role as a private citizen, the legal arguments put forth by his team sometimes strike lawyers not involved in the case as much about setting a political narrative than about dealing with the possibility of a federal prosecution. There seems to be a huge disconnect between what's actually happening, a real-life court case surrounding a real-life investigation, and what they're actually doing, which is treating it like they've treated everything else, recklessly and thoughtlessly. Chuck Rosenberg, a former U.S. attorney and FBI official, said of Donald Trump's approach, and for an average defendant on an average case, that would be a disaster. Donald Trump's legal team has had a few small procedural wins. On Saturday, a federal judge in Florida signaled that she was inclined to support Mr. Trump's request for a special master to review the materials seized by the government in the search of Mar-a-Lago on 8th of August. It is not clear how much the appointment of a special master would slow or complicate the government's review of the material. Donald Trump's team has suggested that it would be a first step towards challenging the validity of the search warrant, but it also gives the Justice Department, which is expected to respond this week, an opportunity to air new details in public through their legal filings. Some of the Trump lawyers' efforts have also appeared ineffective or misdirected. M. Eben Corcoran, in his 25th of May letter, made much of Donald Trump's powers to declassify material as president and cited the specific law on the handling of classified material that he said did not apply to a president. The search warrant, however, said federal agents would be seeking evidence of three potential crimes, none of which relied on the classification status of the documents found at Mar-a-Lago. The law on the handling of classified material cited by M. Eben Corcoran in the letter was not among them. Two lawyers are working with Donald Trump on the documents case. M. Eben Corcoran and Jim Trusty have prosecutorial experience with the federal government, but the team was put together quickly. Jim Trusty was hired after Donald Trump saw him on television, people close to the former president have said. M. Eben Corcoran came in during the spring, introduced by another Trump advisor during a conference call in which Mr. Corcoran made clear he was willing to take on a case that many of Mr. Trump's other advisers were seeking to avoid, people briefed on the discussion have said. Donald Trump's allies have reached out to several other lawyers, but have repeatedly been turned down. Mr. Corcoran, in particular, has raised eyebrows within the Justice Department for his statements to federal officials during the documents investigation. People briefed on the investigation say officials are uncertain whether Mr. Corcoran was intentionally evasive or simply unaware of all the materials still kept at Mar-a-Lago and found during the 8th of August search by the FBI. Mr. Corcoran did not respond to a request for comment. Taylor Budowich, a spokesman for Donald Trump, said only that Mr. Trump and his legal team continue to assert his rights and expose the Biden administration's misuse of the Presidential Records Act, which governs all pertinent facts, has been complied with and has no enforcement mechanism. Even before Mr. Corcoran joined Donald Trump's legal team, Trump's legal filings in various cases read like campaign rally speeches that he had dictated to his lawyers. The former president has a history of approaching legal proceedings as if they are political conflicts, in which his best defense is the 74 million people who voted for him in the 2020 election. The closest thing to a legal quarterback in Donald Trump's orbit is Boris Epstein, a one-time lawyer at the firm Milbank, who was a political advisor to Donald Trump in 2016, ultimately becoming a senior staff member of his inaugural effort and then a strategic advisor on the 2020 campaign. Boris Epstein has championed Donald Trump's claims, dismissed by dozens of courts of law, that the election was stolen from him, and has risen to a role he has described to colleagues as an in-house counsel, helping to assemble Donald Trump's current legal team. Mr. Trump's advisers continue to insist that he was cooperating before the search in returning the documents. They have also suggested that they were quick to respond to Justice Department concerns, citing what they described as a request in June that a stronger lock be placed on the door leading to the storage area, where several boxes of presidential records had been kept. Yet the unsealed affidavit showed a portion of a letter from a Justice Department lawyer sent to Donald Trump's legal team that did not specify anything about a lock and read less like a request and more like a warning. The classified documents taken from the White House have not been handled in an appropriate manner or stored in an appropriate location, the letter read. Accordingly, we asked that the room at Mar-a-Lago where the documents had been stored be secured and that all of the boxes that were moved from the White House to Mar-a-Lago, along with any other items in that room, be preserved in that room in their current condition until further notice. During the search on 8th of August, the FBI found additional documents in that area and also on the floor of a closet in Mr. Trump's office, people briefed on the matter have confirmed. Donald Trump and a small circle within his group of current advisers maintained that he was entitled to keep documents he took from the White House, or that he had already declassified them, or that they were packed up and moved by the General Services Administration, an assertion flatly denied by that federal agency. Donald Trump, people familiar with his thinking say, sees the Attorney General Merrick Garland not as the federal government's chief law enforcement officer, but rather as a political foe and someone with whom he can haggle about how much anger exists over the situation. Shortly before Merrick Garland announced that he was seeking to unseal the search warrant, an intermediary for Donald Trump reached out to a Justice Department official to pass along a message that the former president wanted to negotiate, as if he was still a New York developer. The message that Donald Trump wanted conveyed, according to a person familiar with the exchange, was, "The country is on fire. What can I do to reduce the heat?" A Justice Department spokesman would not say if the message ever made it up to Merrick Garland. But the senior leadership was befuddled by the message and had no idea what Mr. Trump was trying to accomplish, according to an official.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Protests in Iran have now had a counter-protest in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. Countrywide anti-riot and pro-government protests were held much bigger than what was held on Friday. Iranians condemned the rioters to have assaulted religious sanctities like mosques. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the destructive role that foreign countries have played, including their social media tactics, and how Iranian authorities and people will not fall victim to their strategies, which for the most part have the goal of regime change in mind. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Masoud Shajara joins us. He's a political analyst from London. Also joining us, Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener. Welcome to you both. I will first start with you, Masoud Shajara. We've looked at these countrywide demonstrations that took place today, which were in the hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions, as I just indicated, including in the capital, Tehran. Really a breath of fresh air when we take a look at the scenes for the past nights of just vandalism and riots and the destruction of property. Your initial thoughts on the huge turnout today?
It really is very telling how ordinary people have come out and sort of demonstrating against what has been very clearly misuse of the issue by a group of people, and turning the what is very tragic death of a very young woman into a sort of regime change campaign. And I think the real reason why so many people have come out today is exactly that. They are recognizing that there is a misuse and abuse of sentiment of ordinary people regarding this young woman and what is the family are going through, and how they are sort of misusing this whole process for their political end. And it's been directed, wooed, and supported by the West and Israel and everything else. The evidence is very clear, and it's very unfortunate, because I think the issue is a very important issue. As Mr. Raisi, in his phone call with the father of this young woman, indicated that there has to be a proper investigation, and he actually promised a proper investigation. And indeed, even the father of this young woman have actually complained and disassociated himself and the family from this sort of misuse and abuse of what the family is going through. And I think this is really very important for ordinary people to come out and sort of oppose this sort of barbaric actions that have been taken by a minority of people trying to undermine the emotional feeling of many, both inside Iran and outside, for what this family is going through currently.
Indeed. Well, when we want to take a look at the way that these protests have turned out, Robert Fantina, obviously you had an unfortunate incident that happened. So that's our starting point. And then you have the news that's been all over the place in the media covered, whether it's inside Iran or outside. And then you have a protest that began. But we noticed how quickly those protests actually were then led to the destruction of property, which wasn't even really, you see, you can't, if a stone is thrown at a store, it's one thing. But when you have mosques that are being burnt and destroyed, or when you have ambulances that are being destroyed in the dozens, or security forces to be attacked, police stations to be attacked, it's a far cry from just regular protest. At least that's what logic dictates, which then obviously analysts like yourself need to be asked, what happened? How did it get to that point?
That's a very good question, because as you mentioned, legitimate protest is valid anywhere. Peaceful people peacefully protesting government policy that they don't like, that's their right anywhere. But when they are damaging or destroying mosques, when they are damaging and destroying emergency vehicles, ambulances, and so on, this is not protest. This is coming from some other source. Now, the United States, of course, has for years wanted regime change in Iran. It's done everything it can do to...
Go ahead. You just cut off for a second. Go ahead, if you can just repeat what you said.
Okay, yeah. Sure. The United States has for years wanted regime change in Iran. It's done everything it could to foster that. So one might look at these protests and see where the source of them is. Certainly, people are angry about what happened to this poor young woman, but there is a way of demonstrating their anger that does not include violence. However, the United States is a nation that believes in violence, that believes that that's the way of getting things done. This is evidenced by its many wars and aggressions throughout the world. The United States has covert agents operating in many countries, and certainly in Iran. So it wouldn't be too unusual or far-fetched to say that some of this violence is being encouraged and fostered and started by the United States.
Okay, we're going to get into that in a minute. The questions that come up, Masoud Shajar, are looking at the videos and the incidents that have happened. There's a very important perspective to look at these protests, where these questions come up, where Western media are looking at this in a different light, as vulgar and as violent as some of the incidents that I'm going to cite right now, where you have these so-called protesters actually hurting other civilians. They're slitting the throats of police officers. They're knifing people. They're vandalizing public property. Or they're carrying weapons, ammunition, and even explosives. You see, that aspect of it doesn't sound like these are regular protesters.
Absolutely. And the sort of incompetent, or it's not even incompetent, and the sort of coercion of the Western media, it really is unbelievable. This actually proves what we've been saying for a very long time, that fair reporting and unbiased reporting, it's something that is only an illusion. What is left of it is an illusion that it happens. It doesn't happen. We had a side panel at the UN 3 days ago with Professor David Miller going over how Islamophobic, how biased the media is. And, you know, this is not, unfortunately, something new. It's not just happening in Iran. Right now, yesterday, in Britain, in Trafalgar Square, these protesters were shouting, long live Israel, Iran Republic. I mean, what does long live Israel has got to do with the unfortunate death of a young woman? And today, they actually attacked a Arba'in procession in Hyde Park, injuring many people. And right now, from what I've been told, just before coming on air, and they have gathered outside the mosque in Maida Vale, and they're throwing a stone at their broken windows. So it's not, they're not just bringing destruction and barbarism in Iran and in Tehran. In London, they're implementing and doing the same policy. This has got nothing to do whatsoever. A group of people, most of them, overwhelming majority of them, not Iranian, going on a procession for Arba'in, it's got nothing to do with the unfortunate death of a young woman in Iran. But this is what this has become. It really has got no relation whatsoever with the unfortunate situation. This, it seems that there were a whole group of people organized and just waiting for the right time to come out and actually create chaos and death and destruction.
Yeah, indeed. And one of the things that I failed to mention here is we have had deaths. We've had over 40 deaths as far as records go. And this is something that the government itself has announced. So when you're looking at the deaths, then we need to take a look at the foreign hands that are at play over here. Robert Fintina, we are looking at elements of Daesh terrorist group that have been cited. We're looking at some other groups also, such as maybe MKO terrorists and their elements to be involved in these protests, because we know that there's a history and track record that they have had in this country, obviously. And also a group, the Kamala group, a left-wing Kurdish group, and maybe other foreign-backed groups that are have infiltrated, I'm going to use the word infiltrated, these protests. Again, the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says Iranians have a right to protest. But when you have these types of elements to have infiltrated these protesters and the protests themselves, then it becomes a different story. Why do you think there's been a convergence of these groups into these protests? Why do they feel that they have to come into this and create the havoc that they have?
Groups like MKO have very little presence in Iran generally because the people of Iran don't like them. They don't support them. They don't, as you mentioned, they have the right to do. These groups will try to hijack those demonstrations in an attempt to show that, oh, the people are dissatisfied, they want regime change. Now, as I mentioned before, the United States is always calling for regime change in Iran and is saying that these demonstrations are symbolic or indicative of that desire by the Iranian people. However, we have to remember that 2 years ago, there were demonstrations across the country in the United States. The United States government didn't at that time say, oh, the people want regime change. People were simply demonstrating and protesting against police brutality and racism. Yet when there another country that the United States, for whatever reason, has determined as an enemy, sees demonstrations against some government policy, the United States is ready to say, oh, see, the people want regime change. This is not what the people want. These groups, Daesh, MKO, and others, are simply hijacking what was probably beginning as a peaceful demonstration.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we just got cut off at the end there due to the bad connection. But we got your point, so we're going to move on here, and let's talk about the MKO, or the MEK terrorist cult, as it's called. And there was an interesting statement to bring up right now, which still rings true, Masoud Shajar, and that's what the former Iranian foreign minister actually said. I think it was a couple of years back when this news came out, maybe earlier than that, where he slammed Twitter for blocking social media accounts of real Iranians while overlooking social media influence operations that came at that point from actual bots in Tirana, which was a reference to the group's complex at the Albanian capital, where they conducted relentless online information campaigns. So this opens up the door for your analysis into that and then the social media aspect of this, of how this is being driven by foreign powers. Give us what you think about that.
Well, first of all, social media says that they are committed against violence, against those who promote violence, those who promote divisions in the society and so forth. And the reality is that all those so-called wonderful sentiments have been sort of chucked away when it comes to Iran and MKO and indeed other groups who have been organized manipulating social media, asking and promoting violence, and they're actually booing people. They're guiding people and encouraging people to commit acts of the violence. And nothing being done by the social media and so forth. The other aspect is, as my colleague said, the MKO and MEK have got no support whatsoever in Iran. People have been on the receiving end of their commitment to atrocities against ordinary, innocent citizens, and the statistic for that is very clear and very telling. The only reason that the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia are supporting and financing and promoting and protecting MKO is because they are, first of all, they have got an infrastructure that could be mobilized for this sort of type of thing, and their willingness to kill ordinary innocent people. They've got no morals, as any sort of other terrorist organization will have. As long as they are paid the right amount of money and supported, they will commit any acts of terrorism against the Iranians, as they show what they did in support of Saddam, killing ordinary Iranians and being a traitor by any standard. So the value in supporting MKO, MEK by United States, West, and indeed Israel and Saudi Arabia is that nothing to do whatsoever with any sort of popularity, as they are the most unpopular group within Iran. So this is a sort of unholy marriage between a terrorist group, which have even killed American citizens in past, and is willing to kill for money and for survival. And that is the reason it's being supported. It is outrageous that the social media, with all their commitments to good practices, when it comes to Iran, they actually abandon all that.
Well, you know what's incredible is back in 2019, there was an interesting revelation that was made, not to get into the MKO deal here too much, Robert Fantina, but it's quite incredible when it came out that an Iranian activist wrote dozens of articles for right-wing outlets in the U.S. And then it turns out that this writer by the name of Heshmat Alavi, which was pushing for regime change in Iran, which was in charge of social media accounts and its operation to penetrate inside Iranians' minds, basically, turned out to be no one. He didn't exist. And he was quoted by the U.S., former U.S. President Donald Trump. So the depth that the U.S. is involved here, which you have mentioned on a couple occasions here, Robert Fantina, of this push for regime change, it kind of falls in the lines of it's tired. It's a tired move. The maximum pressure campaign kind of falls with the regime change interchangeably. But it is quite important that they are doing this continuously. Even Anthony Blinken coming out saying we're not going to make the mistake that Obama did and pushing support for this in indirect ways. Why do you think they follow this failed policy when it comes to Iran, which today showed that it will definitely fail based on the numbers that came out protesting?
The United States government leaders have never understood the people of Iran's support for the Iranian government. Because the government is structured in a different way than the U.S. government, the U.S. government officials think it's invalid and that no one could want it. They forget the fact that in 1978, 1979, people overthrew the U.S. Puppet government in Iran and established a government that's only if the decisions they make are pleasing to the U.S. government. And the government, the Iranian revolution was not pleasing to the U.S. government, so they've fought it ever since. As far as why they continue with this failed policy, part of it is simply political. They don't want to be seen as being weak and sometimes it's communism, that's not an issue in Iran. They don't want to be seen weak on anyone that they have determined is an enemy to the United States. So they have determined with complete invalidity or with no validity whatsoever that Iran is a threat, and they've convinced many of the members of the U.S. public that that's the case. And by continuing to foster regime change activities, sanctions, and so on, they're showing their constituents that they're strong against this imagined threat. And the only thing that's important to government officials is their reelection, and they think this is a way of accomplishing that.
You're there in London, Master Shajarat, and we had the Tehran summoning the British ambassador to protest the role of the London-based Persian language media outlet there, which I'm sure you know the name, which is government-run, which is short, basically, of the way they're covering it. It's just short of saying, here's a handbook that we're going to read out loud of how you should carry and incite violence. These are the steps to do it, really. So my question is, where is Ofcom? What happened to Ofcom? You say something about Palestinians in the wrong way that rubs Israel the wrong way, and Ofcom jumps in and gives you a warning. Where are they?
Yeah, it really is outrageous. I mean, also, I'm sure you and the viewers know that that particular channel is a government channel, and the foreign section of World Service of it, which what we are talking about, is actually financed directly by the Foreign Office. So it is politically sort of controlled. But you will not see on Twitter or anywhere else any warning that this is a sort of a government-run outfit. And you're right. It's outrageous. It's really totally unacceptable. But I think I'd like to actually say something else here as well. You know, we're talking about regime change. Regime change itself is illegal and unacceptable. There's no business of anyone trying to actually change a government anywhere else. You know, if you try to do that in the United States or even interfere in the election, there will be such a huge outcry, rightly so. But here, we're not even talking about regime change in a way that they change the current government in Iran into a democratic government or, you know, any sort of acceptable government. What they're trying to do is to repeat what they did to Libya, to Syria, to Iraq, to Afghanistan, totally destroy the whole of infrastructure and create such a chaos that the only thing will flourish will be extreme sort of terrorist activity like Daesh and so forth. And that is what their plan is. And People who came out today in Iran, they understand this. They understand that this interference has got nothing to do with wishing them a better future in whatever shape or politics. It really is to destroy the infrastructure, to put back Iran 100 years, exactly what they've done in Libya and what the Libyans are facing right now. And that is what Iranians don't want. And that's why they come out and they say, no interference in our affairs. Keep your hands off Iran.
We could cite so many examples, Robert Fatina, about the double standards that are applied over here, and of course the interference overall that Iran really condemns, and they have every right to do that. But I'm going to add to those examples. In no shape or form am I saying two wrongs make a right. But when we talk about the fact that a woman at this point lost her life here, what about what happened to Shireen Abu Akleh? She was a woman. She was killed and assassinated in cold blood. The U.S. came out and said convincingly that this was not something that was done on purpose. And here we are. There's no word really on that except here and there. Or when we had the other day, earlier this week, actually, we had a 15-year-old Iraqi high school girl, Zainab Assam al-Khazali, who was killed in broad daylight by American troops. It was during a military drill. But you don't see what efforts are being put as it is on Iran as to these two incidents. So in that case in point, again, is it because the issue of Iran, topic of Iran, is that sensitive because they want to obtain their political goals at the end, which is what you have said?
That's certainly part of it. The U.S. wants to obtain its geopolitical goals, goals that it has for it's the world order that it sees that would benefit it only, not benefit the people of the United States, but benefit the wealthy and the leaders of the United States. That's all they're really interested in. With the situation with Shireen Abu Akleh, this was an assassination. Independent media outlets in the United States have said this was a targeted assassination. The United States government will not confirm that, will not agree with that. The United States will do what is it sees is best for the leadership and the wealthy United States. The killing of this young Iraqi girl, which is horrific, these things happen at military bases around, U.S. military bases around the world. The amount of damage, the pollution, the amount of crimes that these soldiers commit is shocking.
Okay.
But the United States has agreements that exclude it from accountability.
Thank you very much for that. We're fresh out of time. Robert Fantina there, author and journalist from Kitchener.